lives. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, those trees that are used for sedition, concealment of conspiracies, and ambushing of Muslims can be cut. And number two, we should be alert and vigilant against the stratagems of the enemies and should not give them a chance to cause further harm. Dear listeners, God bless you and goodbye.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favour, 79 against and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election.
Among the many weights I have on my shoulders today is the fact that I am the first woman ever to lead this nation as Prime Minister.
During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds.
Ma la nostra priorità...
Our priority today must be to curb high energy prices and accelerate in every way the diversification of supply sources and domestic production. The context in which the government will have to act is very complicated, perhaps the most difficult since the World War II.
Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy chargé d'affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia after its annexation of Crimea.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement is doubling down on its threats to target foreign cargo ships attempting to enter Yemeni waters illegally to steal oil and other natural resources. This after the government recently fired warning shots toward a Greek oil ship attempting to illegally load an estimated 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil from a port terminal in the province of Hadramaut. The warning shots forced the Greek cargo ship to abandon its mission and use its own fuel to head back home empty-handed.
This fuel ship was attempting to steal 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil worth millions of dollars. This money is supposed to be allocated to the Central Bank of Yemen, which would then be distributed to pay labor salaries across the country. Unfortunately, this money was transferred to a bank belonging to the Saudi royal family and was used to fund the American-Saudi aggression on Yemen.
According to the government in Sana'a, ending years of plundering and looting of the Yemeni natural wealth is essential to stimulate the Yemeni economy. It also pulls Yemen out of the decades of poverty and economic instability, which has already left millions of Yemenis in poverty. An initiative, the Sana'a government says, is promising to make it a reality. Observers believe that the world now needs to recognize that it is dealing with a new Yemeni nation, one that will never compromise its dignity and sovereignty.
The new identity of Yemen is because people's demands are now being met, whereby the Yemeni people are finally getting what they deserve as they reap the benefit of their natural resources, which used to be exploited and plundered. The latest warning shots we sent are an example of the military and political leadership's strength, pose, and determination to protect the people of Yemen.
Yemen has for decades been described as the poorest country in the Middle East. However, the underlying reasons why that is the case are hardly ever discussed. According to experts we spoke with, one of the main reasons is the systematic exploitation of Yemen's natural wealth by the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
With the latest developments, foreign countries and companies who have a history in plundering Yemen's natural resources will have to think twice about entering the country's waters illegally. As the Ansar Allah movement has made it very clear, it will not hesitate to use decisive military force to protect what it calls the Yemeni people's wealth. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials, he definitely has the experience, been there in the, as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC 23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth. What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light-years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially in the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us, and we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The 18th General Assembly of the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies gathered up members of the media entity in Tehran to discuss new trends in news production and explore areas of cooperation between its members.
So basically, OANA has now become somewhat of a center of the world-balanced approach to journalism. Nowadays, it's quite difficult to find media companies outside of Asia and Africa who are looking for a balanced approach to news. Basically, a lot of the major media companies of the world have decided to play only for one side.
I'm from Lebanon's state news agency. I believe this summit provides a platform for media diplomacy between the member news agencies to reach common grounds on world affairs.
OANA currently has 43 members from 35 countries, covering two-thirds of the world population. As a member, the Islamic Republic News Agency, or shortly IRNA, is hosting this year's General Assembly, based on a voting that took place during the 17th OANA summit in Seoul, South Korea.
Today is a good opportunity for the representatives of prominent news agencies present in Tehran for the OANA meeting to observe the conditions in Iran. An independent media current is needed to disseminate the realities.
Formed in 1961 on UNESCO's initiative, the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies is an association of news agencies from UNESCO member states in the Asia-Pacific region. OANA provides a newswire service containing articles provided by its members. Aside from IRNA, Iran's Fars News and Mehr News agencies are also among OANA members.
Delegates here say OANA's main goal is to break the Western monopoly on media and to present an alternative narrative on regional and global developments, as opposed to, quote, the narrative offered by mainstream media. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk, as Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation. The streets in the center are quiet as Ukraine continues to bomb the city. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets, as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There is no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine. But it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine, but when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves.
I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much. I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join
Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
It's taken him a few weeks longer than anticipated, but former Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister-elect of the UK, and of course, the first ethnic minority to hold either position. In a rather stage-managed affair, Sunak made his first public address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together.
Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they can all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running ahead, well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings, they don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister. Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In Britain, the new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has vowed to bring integrity to No. 10 Downing Street. The new Prime Minister has pledged to fix mistakes of his predecessor, but return of a former Home Secretary has alarmed some MPs in the House of Commons. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has pledged to bring integrity and accountability as Prime Minister on his first day at No. 10, but gambled by restoring Suella Braverman to the Home Office less than a week after she was forced to resign for a security breach. In a reshuffle billed as returning experienced hands to the top jobs, Rishi Sunak also risks alienating backers of his leadership rival, Penny Mordaunt, for dashing her hopes of promotion and leaving her with no option but to stay in a minor role. As he entered No. 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister, the fifth in 6 years, Sunak said his government vowed to fix the mistakes of his predecessor, Liz Truss, and warned of difficult decisions to come. His first cabinet reshuffle attempted to maintain financial stability by keeping Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor of the Exchequer and bridge the divide with former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his supporters by sticking with the Foreign Secretary James Cleverly and the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace. He installed Dominic Raab, his own key ally, who described Truss's economics as a suicide note, as his Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary. However, Rishi Sunak made several decisions that have surprised and even alarmed some MPs, as he reappointed Suella Braverman as Home Secretary and declined to promote his former rival, Penny Mordaunt. He also appointed David Davis as Welsh Secretary, despite his controversial comments on subjects including face veils, child refugees, climate change. Suella Braverman, who still harbours her own leadership ambitions, was handed a job 6 days after she was forced to resign for a security breach for emailing confidential policy to a backbench MP, John Hayes, and trying to copy in his wife, but mistakenly emailing it to another MP's office. Officials raised the alarm that Braverman may have been sharing sensitive information outside the department. The return of Suella Braverman, a Eurosceptic right-winger, drew a shocked reaction from some MPs on the moderate wing of the Conservative Party, but is widely seen as a payback for her endorsement of Rishi Sunak when Boris Johnson still threatened a comeback during the leadership race last week. Sky News Australia has more on the same story. The new British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has vowed to bring integrity and humility to No. 10 Downing Street, but warned Conservative Party must unite or die. The newly elected British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, declared in his first remarks that Britain needs stability and unity, adding he will do his best to bring the country together as it navigates a profound economic challenge. Rishi Sunak will be the United Kingdom's 57th Prime Minister after he was elected unopposed as the Conservative Party leader. The new Prime Minister will meet King Charles III on Tuesday at Buckingham Palace. He will there be invited to form a new government before he travels to No. 10 Downing Street, where he will make his first official statement as Prime Minister of Britain.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That's what a UN-appointed commission of inquiry has said. The Rights Commission has called on the UN to end Israel's permanent occupation and urges prosecution of Israeli officials. As expected, Tel Aviv rejected the report as being anti-Semitic. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of the report and examine the role of the International Court of Justice and other international bodies in holding Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. Joining us for tonight's discussion, we have manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto. And also from Vancouver, international coordinator at Samarun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Ms. Charlotte Cates.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates in Vancouver. The report by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, which in fact will be presented to the General Assembly later in October, accuses Israel of violating international law by making its control over the West Bank permanent and by annexing land claimed by the Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank and Syrian land in the Golan Heights. Well, there have been many reports in this regard. In your opinion, what makes this report different?
In a lot of ways, this report isn't necessarily different, because we have seen, many, many very good reports published by many good UN commissions and agencies over the years that establish the incontrovertible facts that the Israeli occupation routinely violates international law. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the entire creation of the Zionist project on the land of Palestine, this is an exercise of colonialism. Colonialism itself is illegal under international law. So it really even goes beyond the 1967 military occupation to the nature of the Zionist settler project itself. What it does show, however, is that despite the influence of imperialist states like the United States, Canada, European Union countries, the UK, that there still is a measure of independence, and that the fact is that all of the military, political, and diplomatic support provided for the Zionist project by these states is not able to cover up, obscure, or hide the truth of the matter, which is that the Palestinian cause is a just struggle for justice, liberation, and return, and that on a daily basis, it is Palestinian rights that are being violated by an ongoing, Zionist onslaught of mass imprisonment, extrajudicial killings, occupation, colonization, siege, denial of the right of return, and crimes that go on and on for 74 years.
Firas Al-Najm, the report says there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law due to its permanence and the Israelis' de facto annexation policies Of course, it says it should not deprive the occupied power of its statehood, nor its sovereignty. When will these condemnations go past just being mere platitudes? When will there be action?
Unfortunately, the United Nations is a biased body, and they have not really done anything for the Palestinian cause. They have never imposed sanctions or passed real resolutions that make real changes and punish and penalize the Zionist war criminal regime and the occupiers of the Holy Land of Palestine. And it's a continuous thing. We've been seeing this for 74 years, and it does not stop. I mean, every month there's some type of aggression. Every few days now it's more constant now, because they feel, there's nobody's going to punish them. The United Nations is quiet. Most of the international key players are quiet as well. And, the ones with the veto power and so on. I mean, few countries are speaking out and putting pressure and supporting the Palestinians. And one of them, obviously, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's why there's a huge campaign to defame them right now and to paint this wrong picture that they're human rights abusers, where they forget about the real human rights abusers is the Zionist regime. How much annexation, how many houses have they stole from Palestinians? And it's been recorded because of this modern technology that we have. How many phones were used to really, highlight these issues of human rights violations? International law is being breached day and night by the Zionist regime. And the thing is, the Zionist regime really just disregards all these bodies because they've never held them really accountable. It's unfortunate, like even when the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was looking to investigate the Zionist regime for war crimes, the former prime minister of the Zionist regime comes out and says this is a kangaroo court. He says we don't even recognize it. So this is the type of rhetoric, this is the type of language these people have. They think they're above the law, they have the state of arrogance. And unfortunately, the only way it seems like it works with the Zionist regime is by military ways and military means. And we've seen that things change once the strength of the Palestinian resistance, hits the Zionist regime. We see that now with Gaza, they negotiate differently, and they pull back and they retract and they become submissive, even though they have all the type of advanced weapons. But this strong united resistance against the Zionist regime, I think, is the only solution. Because if we want to rely on the United Nations, we've seen they haven't done nothing. How come they have always spoke about these issues, have had condemnations and statements, but we haven't seen any real action? But we see now real action on the issue of Russia and Ukraine. How much sanctions have been imposed against Russia? How many meetings, important and emergency meetings have happened in the United Nations to condemn Russia, to impose all types of restrictions and sanctions against Russia and all its officials and so on? And it's only a conflict less than 1 year. We're talking 74 years of occupation. For us as a human rights organization, we don't want to see violence. We don't want to see people dying. We don't want to see, destabilization. But at the end of the day, we have to be logic, and we have to look at things, in a realistic way. And the realistic way is that the Zionist regime is only dealt with and things change when resistance is strong.
Charlotte Cates, that's an issue I wanted to bring up later on in the show, but now that Mr. Najem alluded to it, can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestinians?
Well, I think here it's always really important to talk about who we mean when we say the international community, because by and large, that term is used to mean the imperialist powers that are responsible for creating war, occupation, colonialism, extraction of resources from people around the world. And so the term international community, as if the responsible international community are those who are responsible for the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so the reason why we see a difference in these responses, and such a clear and striking difference, isn't even that these states are hypocritical or that they have double standards. It's that they have interests, and that their interests are in seeing Zionist colonial power extended in occupied Palestine and dividing the Arab people and dividing the people of the region from one another through the presence of this essentially military colonial project of the Zionist state in occupied Palestine. And so in much the same way, we see that the United States is very much pursuing a war by multiple means against Russia and against any other power that it views as a potential challenger to its domination of the extraction of the resources of colonized and formerly colonized people around the world. And so it's no surprise that these imperialist powers are acting in their interests. But that's not the only international community, and that's not the only international community that matters. Obviously, there are a number of states, I mean, including Iran, including Arab states that have not yet conceded to the role of normalization, including resistance forces like we see in Lebanon, and including popular movements and people's movements around the world, both in the global south and the countries that have risen up against colonialism and continue to defend themselves, and in the capitals, the cities, the streets, and the towns of the imperialist powers themselves, that recognize that what is happening in Palestine is, in fact, a grand crime against humanity, and one that is being supported by U.S. imperialism, and one that needs to be brought to an end and to be stopped. And so that's why we are seeing a growth in campaigns to boycott and sanction Israel. And that's why instead what we're seeing are these imperialist powers instead trying to criminalize those boycott movements while saying that it is necessary to use sanctions as kind of a weapon of domination and control against countries from Iran to Russia to really one third of the world are subjected to U.S. sanctions of some form or another. And so it's really necessary to do everything that we can to build up that real international community, of all of those forces that are involved in resistance to fight back and to stand with the Palestinian people and to stand with the Palestinian resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, because we can't rely on the United Nations. Instead, we have to act and organize.
Firas Al-Najm, the Israelis have rejected this report, obviously, calling its commissioners as being anti-Semitic and questioning their legitimacy. They say the report damages the UN's credibility and its human rights mechanisms. Also, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said that Israel is consistently unfairly targeted in the UN system, including in the course of this commission of inquiry. How hypocritical are these responses?
I mean, this is the hypocrisy of the Zionist regime, because it was established on hypocrisy and contradiction. And, this is what they always try to accuse people of, this victim card. And either they play the Holocaust card and try to, play the victim card all the time, so, people can have empathy for them, and they want to justify crimes by looking at crimes that have happened to let's just say the Jewish people before, or they play the anti-Semitic card, and play the victim card again, because they run out of cards now. They're in a very weak state right now, the Zionist regime, so they'll just keep throwing these type of cards around, and they don't get nowhere with them. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, they think they're above the law. Like, when we argue with these people all the time and have different discussions and arguments and protests, we see that their mentality truly is that they believe that they are the chosen people, this is their chosen land, and this is their chosen battle. And they're brainwashed in this kind of manner, you know what I mean? And they don't care about international organizations, and they think that, God is assisting them in this all these criminal activities. But at the end of the day, we know that the resistance will enter Palestine. The resistance is strong. And the axis of resistance is more unified and more experienced now than ever in its history. And like Sayyid Khamenei said, the supreme leader of the Iranian government, he said that the solution is for the West Bank to be armed as Gaza, just something similar to Gaza, like the same model. Hopefully that will transfer to West Bank. And we see that right now. There is an ignition, and there is this reviving revolutionary lifestyle happening now, where a lot of youth are rising up and fighting back the Zionist regime while they think they can just, you know, breach the international laws, go into Palestinian territories as they please, break all these, you know, people's houses and things like that. And, you know, we're hopeful. I mean, like us, freedom people are defending the people that are oppressed. We are really honestly hopeful that we're going to see a free Palestine in the near future. And it's unfortunate, this hypocrisy where they're crying about one controversial case such as Mahsa Amini, and then they leave all the dead people that get killed in Palestine, such as Shirin Abu Akla, and all these people that we see clearly how the Israelis don't even care about any humanity at all. They kill women, they kill kids, they kill mothers, grandmothers, you know, and nobody speaks about them. There's no outrage. There's no huge, you know, Twitter hashtags being trended by all these government officials and all these organizations and all these activists. You know, but they focus on that one case because they want to hurt Iran, because Iran is the main supporter of Palestine. And that's what hurts them. They hate a sovereign Iran and a strong Iran supporting the oppressed resistance of Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, the commission demanded the international system and individual states must act and uphold their obligations under international law. That must begin at this session of the General Assembly with the referral to the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued occupation. This is, of course, an excerpt of the report from the commission. How can the ICJ have the leeway to intervene when Israel is not a member of the court and rejects its jurisdiction?
Yes, I mean, the ICJ has, of course, ruled before on Israeli crimes in 2004, on the building of the apartheid wall. And of course, at the ICC, in addition to what's happening at the ICJ, at the ICC, what we've seen is that, like, for example, legal organizations that are working to bring Palestinians' complaints to the ICC are being branded by the Zionist regime as terrorist organizations, essentially in retaliation for what they're doing to expose the Israeli occupation. We know that these kinds of agencies and even these courts aren't going to act on their own because they're also not apolitical institutions. So, for example, at the ICC, we've seen an announcement that Ukraine, once again, is being prioritized, whereas Palestine has been waiting for justice at the ICC for a very long time. And in fact, the entire decision to handle their case was viewed as controversial and almost at risk at any time, despite the fact that there is an international recognition of a Palestinian state, however limited and insufficient that is. But that, once again, speaks to the fact that we see justice in the courts and in international arenas when we demand and seek justice in the streets and when the Palestinian resistance is organizing, leading, and fighting back. And that's why it is so important that we participate in actions. On October 29th, there's going to be a march in Brussels to the European Parliament to demand an end to the European Union's complicity in ongoing Zionist war crimes and crimes against humanity through, for example, we see the EU-Israel Association Agreement meeting with Israeli occupation leaders, and even when issuing weak criticisms, providing nothing more than strong, fundamentally diplomatic, military, financial, and political support to the Zionist regime. And so we want to encourage people everywhere that you can to support the Palestinian people in their resistance by taking to the streets, by coming out and marching, and by joining us in Brussels on October 29th to march to the European Parliament at 2 p.m.
Firassa Najem, the report focused on a very important issue, and that's the issue of settlements, on how Israel has sustained and advanced its quote-unquote settlement enterprise, including statements made by Israeli officials indicating the intent to maintain permanent control over the land in violation of international law. The report also found that land is often confiscated for military purposes, but then used for settlement construction. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Yes, I mean, this is part of their, plan is to weaken the Palestinians and always show them military pieces everywhere in every corner, so, you know, they can never think that they will ever have their own army and their own state and their own strength and sovereignty. This is one of the main focuses of the Zionist regime, because they know that after they get that strength, then they will start to talk about all the human rights abuses for over these years, all the war crimes. Then they will be talking about compensation, bringing back all the refugees from Palestine. So that means their plan would have to fail, and they won't be able to fully control the land the way that they want to. So this is one of their plans, and it will fail. I think the only type of resolutions we can have to put some pressure, obviously, if the United Nations wakes up actually and really wants to implement the laws truly and put some severe sanctions against Israel, maybe they'll retract a little bit and start to pull away from these settlements. Or the other way is obviously the Palestinian resistance and the rockets, because then, you know, at that point, the settlers and occupiers will feel discouraged and feel, you know, fearful that they have to leave that area because the Palestinians want their land back and they're going to fight for it. And, you know, well, like we said, we don't want to see no bloodshed. But if that's the only way it is to acquire your land and to liberate your land, then that's the only way. And it's also, you know, it's sanctioned in the Charter of Rights under the United Nations. Any occupied nation has the right to resist, right? And as we see right now, the Ukrainians are getting all types of weapons from Canada, from all types of countries, and it's totally illegal and it's totally honorable. But then when somebody wants to help the Palestinians, he's a sponsor of terrorism. It's like Iran supports the Palestinian resistance, you know, inside Gaza, and they call them sponsors of terror. You see the hypocrisy and the bias. Type of actions is unbelievable, you know, but it's all turning on them anyways, because we're exposing them. We're going out to these politicians and we're asking them, like, if you're supporting Ukraine and you're so proud of that, why don't you support the Palestinians that have been occupied for 74 years? And if you don't believe that they've been occupied, the United Nations says they're occupied. And now we have, you know, these little statements here and there that, you know, confirm that.
All right, that's all the time we have for this show. Thanks to manager Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and international coordinator Samadun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.